This podcast contains swearing and occasional disturbing content.
I don't need to live in this physical realm. I walk around in the physical realm. In the spiritual world is where I live. I exist in places you never even dreamed of. Strange.
And welcome to the High Strangeness Podcast, episode 25. My name is Gav.
My name's Sarah.
We are your hosts today on this lovely, magical tour of shiny, polished, floored, grey and blue corridors of a big, cold building, aren't we?
Yes.
Part two of the Broadmoor Hospital, psychiatric hospital, overseen by the likes of Jimmy Savile for years on end.
Yeah.
What a crazy thing that was.
Definitely. Just beggars belief, didn't it, really?
How does that happen?
I just can't.
So the fact that we're just looking at the patients inside the hospital, we have a prolific paedophile, monstrous paedophile, overlooking the hospital.
Yeah, what just running the place. And he was probably one of the worst people that Britain has ever produced. Like, in charge of this place is just insane. Crazy, you just can't even fucking go there. It's crazy.
No, totally. So that is what we're doing today, and it's our part two. Hopefully you listened to part one last time. This time it's three sets of cases, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we're going to do Robert Maudsley, who's undeservedly, in my opinion, been excessively over penalised, you might say, for what he's done, you know, and he got over sensationalised in the papers as well. He got called Hannibal the Cannibal and stuff like that.
Has there been a film based on?
No, not on him.
Oh, surprising.
No, not on him.
It might be rights of something, like he might not sign off rights, or is he too much in the public eye, he wouldn't sell well?
Probably not. Probably wouldn't sell well, I suppose, but then, you know, you've got to deal with all the over-sensationalised stuff in the paper about him.
Mm.
You know, how would they then carry it off if it's not true? You know, I suppose it'd have to be fictional, wouldn't it? Based on him.
Yeah.
We're going to cover him and also June and Jennifer Gibbons, the Silent Twins.
The Silent Twins. Has there anything been made on those dudes?
No, I did watch a good documentary on YouTube. Okay. About those guys, though. Those girls,
Silent
I suppose.
Silent Twins. Just that name, though, is a movie. Yeah. The Silent Twins.
Well, they weren't really silent. They were kind of silent, but they had their own language kind of between each other, and they used to speak to their younger sister for a time as well.
Mm. Okay.
So, yeah, we heard about them, but it's quite a sad little story as well with them two. And then we're going to give you some early Sutcliffe as well.
Smashing.
Yeah, quite literally.
Brilliant. Oh, P.S. Sutcliffe, eh?
Yeah, which is just a fucking harrowing story. Like, it's so scary. I was watching the Sutcliffe documentary series on Netflix in the UK last night, and it's just so terrifying. You know, that kind of goes into interviews with women that survived him, and it takes you into like the places where the bodies were found as well, and it's just fucking terrifying, you know. Some of these places, like hidden under sofas in wood yards and things like that, you know, it's so just really upsetting. And a lot of his victims were mothers as well.
Okay.
You know,
you're starting to go already, aren't you?
Oh yeah, it's so sad. It really is. It's just really terrifying, and I don't think Peter Sutcliffe often gets the kind of consideration, you know, to think, fucking hell, he was insane. He was absolutely insane. You know, this bloke's fucking nuts.
Right.
Proper.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he's one of, like, Britain's biggest serial killers.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, crazy fucker. Well, today, the cases we're doing today, then we are going to be back next time for a part three.
Mm.
Und toi, ein zwei vier. So yeah, that's what's going on. Anything spooky happened to you recently? Anything going on like that?
No.
We were discussing the bit of carpet just by your window there, weren't we? you've been living it for many years. Then a few years ago, and I sort of first came along and said, "What's going on with your carpet there?
I've got a really threadbare just patch of carpet by my bedroom window, which is really strange. It's been like that since I moved in, yeah, and I hadn't really thought anything of it until you mentioned. Obviously, someone must have been pacing there or just like standing and wearing out the carpet. Streaks,
yeah, right, yeah, just standing there watching everybody.
Curtain switching.
Well, listeners, I hope you've not had anybody standing watching you from a window.
It's like opposite stalking, isn't it?
It is. Weird. Well, I hope everybody is ready to have their clothes whipped off, their gowns placed on them, and their bottoms shown as we all go merrily hand in hand down the blue and grey cold polished floors.
To the
corridors.
Queue for the electroconvulsive therapy.
As we enter Broadmoor Hospital Part 2.
Okay, so Robert Maudsley. He's an English serial killer who is fairly unique due to the fact that he became a serial killer after he was incarcerated.
Really?
Yes.
So he was... I know, obviously, if I ask this question, you go, I'm going to get to that. What is he incarcerated for? Okay.
So, since the death of the scumbag Ian Brady, he has been the longest-serving British prisoner and is one of 66 people in the UK serving a whole life tariff. Maudsley was one of 12 children born on the Speke Estate on the outskirts of Liverpool on the 26th of June 1953. His father was exceptionally violent towards the children and his mother neglected them. Eventually, the neighbours got in contact with social services and the children were removed and sent to an orphanage named Nazareth House. Robert always looks back on this as one of the happiest times of his life, as they had a roof over them, were fed and clothed, and they were allowed to be children and not be punished for it. However, when a family stated that they would like to adopt his brother, the orphanage needed permission from Robert's family. When his grandfather found out about this, he stated that they wouldn't allow it and that they wanted the children returned. So when they returned, the beatings and neglect continued. The children had to sleep on the floor with a coat covering them, as there weren't any blankets or bedclothes, and if they did anything their parents deemed to be misbehaving, they were locked in the cupboard, often for weeks at a time. Sometimes Robert would hide for days, but when he came home, he would only be beaten more severely, with some of his brothers stating that Robert always got the worst of the violence.
Wear protection. If you don't want children, wear
I know, it's crazy, isn't it? So they're 12 kids, you know. Obviously, what? They fucking can't handle that amount of children.
It's just more mouths to feed, and you know that when that happens. Yeah. Oh, that's another mouth to feed. Like, if you don't want that, then don't do that.
Yeah.
But then I suppose they make them work, won't they?
Yeah, I suppose that is a thing, isn't it?
Yeah, they're obviously going to look at them like, well, that want to be another worker.
Yeah, someone to look after us when we're older. It's such a fucked up way of thinking, though. Like, they're fucking people. Mm. You know, you can't put that on them. Like, I don't really expect my kids to do all that kind of shit for me when I'm older. I'm not expecting it. But I'm not expecting it. You know, it's not like the main reason. Ridiculous. So when he was 18, he and two of his brothers decided to run away and Robert headed to London. He soon began working as a sex worker in order to support himself, and he was apparently raped by an associate during this time. So aged 20, around 20 he was by now.
What year was this? He was in London and...
Well, I'm just about to say, on the 14th of March 1974, so I'm assuming it's 70s. Kind of early 70s when he's run,
early
when he runs
London.
Away.
So out of the swinging 60s of London into the sort of early 70s.
Okay. Yeah.
So presumably around the sort of Soho district, I or Charing Cross, I suppose.
Yeah.
Okay.
So on the 14th of March 1974, John Farrell, who had picked Maudsley up for sex, showed him some photographs of underage children that he had been abusing. Maudsley garrotted him and then surrendered himself to the police, stating that he needed psychiatric care. Maudsley was found unfit to stand trial and instead was sent to Broadmoor Hospital. Here he hoped he would get the help he needed, but when he didn't, he became frustrated. In 1977, he and another resident, David Cheeseman, locked themselves in a room with convicted child molester David Francis and tortured him to death over a period of 9 hours.
Wow.
And when officers finally gained access to the room, they apparently had found a spoon lodged in the man's brain through a crack in his skull. That's what they said.
Oh, my God.
But it's not true. Apparently, there was no spoon found.
So these two feathers wanted... Well, paedophiles are very much looked down upon inside.
Yeah, hugely. Any kind of child-related crime.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that's the thing. So, okay. It's one of those weird things, isn't it? When that happens, it's like, oh, sorry, the guy had a spoon in his head. He also was a paedophile.
Yeah.
So I don't really have, unfortunately...
There's not really any sympathy for him, is there?
Not really, unfortunately. You know.
Yeah.
Don't condone killing people, but...
Well, no, but if you're going to kill people...
Well, if you...
I suppose, in my opinion, if you're going to kill people, kill the people that are probably...
Yeah, obviously, that's what... Yeah. It's such a thin line, though, isn't it, really?
It is. Mm. So this earned him the sensationalist nicknames Hannibal the Cannibal and the Brain Eater, and they were touted by the newspapers for headlines, you know, and sales, obviously, but Maudsley does deny that he ever ate any of that guy's brain. And there's no evidence to say that the spoon was found in his...
Do you reckon it was a teaspoon or a dessert spoon?
Oh.
Probably a teaspoon.
I don't know. I think you'd need a dessert spoon, though, because brain's quite wobbly, isn't it, by all accounts?
Well, I don't know. I think if you did a teaspoon,
you wouldn't quite get it on
there.
You don't
have to do the motion with your hand. I'm just dreading
doing a digging motion.
I'm upset that I brought it up now. Let's carry on.
You know, I always take it too far.
Too far. Let's carry on.
Should have learned.
Yeah.
I've lost my place in my notes. The authorities were forced to move him, and he was transferred to Wakefield Prison after being convicted of manslaughter. He wasn't happy about the transfer and made it clear that he wanted to return to Broadmoor. Maudsley was later sentenced to life imprisonment with a recommendation that he should never be released. In 1978, Maudsley killed two prisoners in the same morning. His first victim was Salney Darwood, who had been convicted of the manslaughter of his wife and severe domestic abuse to her as well. Maudsley had invited Darwood to his cell, where he garroted and stabbed him before hiding the body under his bed.
What's his long-term plan?
Hey, Maudsley.
Yeah. Hiding the body under his bed. Well, what's the plan with the body?
Oh, he hasn't got one. He don't care.
Yeah, okay.
He don't give a shit. He wants some help. Yeah. You know, he knows he needs help.
Is this a call for help?
Yeah.
Wow.
I would say so, you know.
My God. Using murder as a call for help.
Well, that's, you know, insane, he's kind of going... he's obviously in the mindset to do a murder... But he knows he needs help as well. That first murder that he committed, he handed himself in because he knew he'd done wrong, and he said that he needed help. You know, he's doing this. He wants to go back to Broadmoor because he wants help. He doesn't want to be, you know, they've transferred him to Wakefield, which is just a standard prison.
Yeah.
So he knows he needs to be somewhere where he can get psychiatric help. So he wants to go back to Broadmoor, you know. So obviously he's doing this and kind of going, look, I'm nuts. You know, you need to send me back to Broadmoor. Because he knows that he needs the help. So yeah, he's got no plan with the body. He doesn't care.
Yeah, he just doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. He then attempted to lure other prisoners in, but they all refused. Maudsley then prowled the wing looking for his next victim, eventually cornering and stabbing prisoner Bill Roberts to death.
So he was doing this is where he turned into a serial killer. Because he's going around doing this murder spree.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. So a few of the other prisoners, because you know the general, you know, any moment something could pop off, but you know the general feeling of the place. And obviously America is a bit more hectic, but imagine that, then just seeing him go along and come out and be like, whoa, what's going on with him? With blood all over him. Knowing something's, okay, it's just normal sort of day, but then going to someone else,
yeah,
like that's unheard of in the of you wouldn't have someone just doing that, but
yeah,
totally. I suppose it would have happened, but not on the regular,
yeah,
of the weirdness and the assaults and stuff.
Yeah. So the guy that he stabbed as well, Bill Roberts, who was serving a 7-year sentence for the sexual assault of a young girl, so he's another pedo.
Oh.
He hacked at Roberts' skull with a makeshift dagger.
Sorry, the one he garroted a moment ago, hid under his bed, was that a sex offender as well?
He'd been convicted of manslaughter of his wife, I think it was, I said.
OK.
And abusing her and stuff.
Spurred him up to get going, and then it's like, right, I know who I'm going for next. Yeah. OK.
So he hacked at Robert's skull with a makeshift dagger and then struck his head against the wall multiple times. Maudsley then calmly walked into the prison officer's room, placed the dagger on the table and told him that the next roll call would be too short. See, he don't care. So he's handed himself in.
And roll just call's going to be too done, short, puts the knife down.
Yeah, like, done two murders.
What do you mean? Like they're going to be straight away though. Bing, bing, bing. He's just killed two people. Like, lock it down. Well, like,
yeah.
Hell.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, so he doesn't care about them discovering it or
no.
anything like that.
That is absolutely insane.
Mm.
I suppose, literally, I suppose.
Yeah, well, no.
Is that called insane? It's like, geez,
it is. Ill. Like, it's to sit here and go, that situation is crazy. You know, obviously, yeah, it is. But yeah, not... I don't know, it's just like, it's so fucked up. Some of these stories are just like, oh, where does the brain go? Mm. It's just bonkers.
Mm.
In 1983, Maudsley was deemed to be too dangerous for a normal prison cell, and prison authorities built a 2-cell unit in the basement of Wakefield Prison. Due to his history of violence, he is escorted at all times when leaving the cell by between 4 to 6 officers. The cells cover 18-foot by 15-foot, and have large bulletproof windows through which he can be observed. The only furnishings are a table and chair, both made of compressed cardboard.
It's a real Hannibal.
Yeah, definitely. Sort of that's what I couldn't find any actual pictures of it.
Escorted amount of people.
But it was saying, like, think Hannibal Lecter.
Absolutely.
When you think of the cell, absolutely. You know, think of the glass. Got kind of acrylic-y kind of walls, you
well,
know.
I'm thinking of almost like little mini Carla Pope fucking drives around in the bulletproof windows have got all glass and stuff because it's like a cute thing.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That's absolutely insane. That's why I'm surprised it's not been a movie made.
I know. You would think, wouldn't you? But it's kind of like, until a little while ago, I'd never heard of this guy.
Right. Wait till Netflix gets on it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
there is a little documentary. I'll link all the documentaries that I've been watching for this up on the Facebook page, but I did find a little documentary about Robert Maudsley and kind of his family, you know. And I think it was his nephew, maybe, that was speaking on the programme, and he was saying, you know, we go every week and we go and see him, you know, and he's still, all his family come along and come and see him. And so he still gets visits and stuff.
Right. Okay.
Hmm. So a toilet and sink are bolted to the floor and the bed is a concrete slab. A solid steel door opens into a small cage within the cell encased in thick see-through acrylic panels with a small slot at the bottom through which officers pass him food and other items. He remains in the cell all day apart from an hour's exercise when he is escorted to the yard by 6 prison officers. He is not allowed contact with any other prisoners. In March 2000, Maudsley unsuccessfully pleaded for the terms of his solitary confinement to be relaxed or to be allowed to commit suicide by cyanide capsule.
Wow.
He also asked for a pet budgie, which was also denied. During talks with doctors, he claimed he heard voices telling him to kill his parents, and he is quoted as saying, "If I had killed my parents in 1970, none of these people would have died."
Presumably because he'd been knocked up.
Yeah.
What exercise do you reckon he does in his hour a day?
I don't know, probably just walking around the yard, isn't it? But you'd think they'd give him something.
The fact, though, that he's like, can you just give me, let me commit suicide? Like, I guess some prisoners in for life are possibly going to go that route anyway, saying, look, just kill me, I don't want this. And the reason they're locked up is the punishment. It's like, you're gonna look, you're not going, you're gonna stay here for the rest of your life and realise how shit this is, just be viewing your mind. But the fact that he's doing that, yeah, and the fact that he's in a psychiatric hospital doing that, it's almost like he's just like, look, I fucking don't want to listen to the people in my mind anymore.
Yeah, is, well,
he must be doped up, though.
He's currently in Wakefield, so they moved him from Broadmoor, but he always wanted to go back to Broadmoor,
so
like I was saying.
Wakefield because, with the ship. Yeah. Right, okay, so he isn't doped up yet, is he? Probably, is he in a course of even any antidepressants?
I'm not sure.
Anything,
I couldn't
find
anything out about his medication and stuff.
Until he gets to Broadmoor, you know.
And I don't, you know, they won't, they're not going to put him back in Broadmoor because they've just spent all that money on making his cell. So, like, instead of making that cell, though, and putting him down there, like, why not just use that money and send him back to Broadmoor and get him the help that he wants?
Absolutely.
Like, why spend the money on fucking keeping him on his own and fucking his head up even more?
But no, the reason was, though,
it's obviously self-aware.
Because of the time, then they're not going to give a shit. Even if the doctor said to him, oh, look, because he'd already been to Broadmoor, yeah? He needs his tablets. They could be like, oh, we forgot to give him, oh, fuck it.
Yeah.
They're not going to care because they could think mental illness, that's just a fucking excuse, that is.
Yeah.
Then it's only, we're only getting nowadays, like the past, what, 10 years or so, we've started getting really more aware that people can be ill with their mind and it isn't just like, oh, I'm just faking it.
Definitely.
You know, so like then, it's no chance.
Mm.
Fuck.
So yeah, it's quite unfortunate.
Yeah, especially because the fact that he is probably getting the shit in his head must be just destroying him so much.
That's it, and
he's
nuts.
He's just slowly dying away, and they're obviously not going to care. And like, I'm not trying to make it like, oh, bless him, bless his little cock socks, but like, because obviously, because he's murdered people and stuff. But
you can kind of have some sympathy for him, though.
He doesn't mean to do it, I guess. You know, it's very so hard to talk about, isn't it? Okay.
But yeah.
Yeah.
That's that. And it is quite sad, you know. He's obviously, he knows that he needs help and he's not getting it.
Yeah.
And that's quite shitty, really.
And that, is that all of that, then, on him? So he then, obviously, after Wakefield, got in back into Broadmoor.
No, he's still in Wakefield.
Oh, you're joking?
No, they just spent all that money building. That's what I was saying. They've spent all that money building that thing for him.
Yeah,
they're not going to send him back to Broadmoor, are they? They're just going to keep him there now. He's still there.
Fuck. Okay, well, maybe now that then he might have a course of antidepressants or something. Or at least a shrink to kind of check on him or something. Or, you know, I'd hope, you know. But I don't know. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So he was at Broadmoor, but he's not anymore.
Yeah.
He was a patient at Broadmoor.
Yeah.
Was Jimmy? I suppose Jimmy was probably there then, dangling his keys.
I would think so. Yeah. I think they were there at the same time.
Jimmy dangling his keys.
Jangle jangle.
I'm not gonna start doing
impressions. No, don't slip into a Jimmy.
Right, go on in.
Okay, so this is June and Jennifer Gibbons. June and Jennifer were identical twins who grew up in Wales. They became known as the Silent Twins, as they only communicated with each other. They wrote fiction novels, and both women spent 11 years in Broadmoor.
They wrote novels?
Yeah.
Did they joint write them, or is it individual?
No, I think they individually wrote them, but at the same time, they wrote quite a lot as well. Yeah.
Are they published?
Yeah, they published some of them themselves.
Right.
But I think they'll be super hard to get hold of. I didn't have a check, actually, but I will have a look and see
how interesting that'd be. I wonder how close they're, because it'd be great to know, was this just your individual idea? You didn't tell your other half, your twin? Yeah.
They both discussed it and decided to start writing.
Yeah, but I mean their story ideas themselves. Then to see if they weren't telling each other about their ideas when they wrote them, how they both, the stories were, as a comparison, because of how their mind works being twins.
Yeah.
Fascinating. This is a developing story.
Yeah, the documentary I watched was really interesting as well. Because you get the view of the other twin who wasn't happy that the other, her sister was kind of a little bit shorter than she was.
Right.
She didn't have the same aspirations and things like that. So the one twin was kind of annoyed by that. You know, she wanted them to be individuals because they weren't the same. Whereas if they were absolutely identical in everything, she would have been happy that they were twins. And she would have wanted them to stay the same. but because they weren't exactly the same.
Right.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's a really strange story, and there's a little twist in it as well, which obviously you don't know about. So I'm kind of being guarded about what I'm saying.
Okay,
here.
Don't say anything, please.
So,
don't
yeah, I'm going to get on with the story.
One was a man. Okay,
go on. Okay, so June and Jennifer, they were born in 1963. They were the daughters of Caribbean immigrants Gloria and Aubrey Gibbons. The Gibbons family moved from Barbados to the UK in the early 1960s as part of the Windrush generation. Gloria was a housewife and Aubrey worked as a technician in the RAF, Royal Air Force. The couple also had a daughter, Greta, born in 1957, and a son, David, born in 1959. In 1960, Aubrey went to stay with a relative in Coventry and soon qualified as a staff technician. Gloria followed with Greta and David several months later. The twins were born on the 11th of April 1963 at a military hospital in Yemen, where their father had been deployed. The family soon relocated, first to England and in 1974 to Haverford West in Wales. The twin sisters were inseparable, and their language, which was eventually found out to be a sped-up Bajan Creole, made it difficult for people to understand them.
Okay.
The family's children were the only children of colour in the community, and all of the children were often ostracised and bullied at school. This proved traumatic for the twins, eventually causing their school teachers to dismiss them early each day so they might avoid after-school bullying. Their language became even more idiosyncratic at this time, and it was unintelligible to others and qualified as an example of cryptophasia, exemplified by the twins' simultaneous actions, which often mirrored each other. So cryptophasia is a phenomenon of a language developed by twins that only the two children can understand.
Mm.
It comes from Greek crypto, meaning secret, and phasia, meaning speech.
Right.
Which I thought was really weird. I don't know of any other examples of it. It's not really a thing I know about.
No.
I thought it was quite interesting.
I hope my co-host from my other show, the podcast on Horned Hill, is listening. Because any day now, as we record this, he's about to have twins.
Yeah. You have to tell us if they have a secret language when they get a bit older.
Absolutely.
That'd be interesting.
So that's interesting. So I feel sorry for... At least, look, there's one thing I can say straight away. At least they have each other.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's going to be like a little Welsh village of all white
people. Yeah, totally.
They are just any person of any colour is going to be looked at and or, you know.
Yeah.
So, like, twins as well.
Yeah,
you know.
Definitely. And obviously they're brothers and sisters because they're all quite close in age. So I was saying on the documentary that I watched yesterday, you know, they all used to get let out like 5 minutes early.
So they wouldn't get bullied, yeah.
Yeah,
and that's so
because
horrible.
They were the only ones in that school who were of colour. Yeah,
it's
fucking
like,
awful. But can you imagine?
Like,
it's
here
like,
you go, you got a 5 minute head start, go.
Yeah.
And the other bullies are there waiting to get out.
Can you imagine those? Like we're talking
the teacher
kind of,
doesn't have control?
Talking like kind of late 60s, early 70s now. That's going to be fucking terrible.
Mm.
You know, attitudes were atrocious back then. Not that there can be much better these days, to be honest, but even so.
Yeah.
You know, it's fucking awful.
Oh, I wouldn't be...
there wouldn't be that level.
There's going to be a town or village somewhere in England which is all white and they still would look upon people of colour as in like, ooh, you know, that's
yeah,
not
definitely.
Ooh. So... If, yeah, this one of
still
those things,
relevant,
isn't it?
I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely, but that's horrible. That's just rubbish.
Yeah,
and they've got this little language. So they've got this Creole. So it's like a Caribbean.
It's kind of like a mix between Caribbean and English, but really, really super fast.
Oh. Wow.
Like, really super fast, so that no one could understand it. I think it was one of their therapists who eventually recorded
and slowed it down and was like,
oh, it's actually kind of English, you know, we can actually understand them.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Imagine how fast their brains are both going.
Yeah, so strange.
What the fuck?
Really odd.
Okay, all right.
The twins became increasingly reserved and eventually spoke to no one except each other and their younger sister, Rose. The girls continued to attend school, although they refused to read and write. In 1974, a medic administering vaccinations at the school noted their impassive behaviour and notified a child psychologist. The twins began seeing a succession of therapists who tried unsuccessfully to get them to communicate with others. They were sent to separate boarding schools in an attempt to break their isolation, but the pair became catatonic and completely withdrawn when parted. When they were reunited, the two spent all their time isolating themselves in their bedroom, engaging in elaborate plays with their dolls. They created many plays and stories, reading some of them aloud on tape as gifts for their sister Rose.
Oh.
Yeah. Inspired by the gift of a pair of diaries on Christmas 1979, they began their writing careers. They sent away for a mail order course in creative writing and each kept an extensive diary and wrote a number of stories, poems and novels, set primarily in the United States and particularly in Malibu, California. The stories involve young men and women who exhibit strange and often criminal behaviour. June wrote a novel titled Pepsi Cola Addict, in which the high school hero is seduced by a teacher, then sent away to a reformatory where a homosexual guard makes moves on him. The two girls pulled together their unemployment benefits in order to get the novel published. Their other attempts to publish novels and stories were unsuccessful.
Right, okay.
So it did, so they managed to do that one themselves.
Right, okay.
But yeah, that's it.
Wow, okay.
In Jennifer's The Pugilist, a physician is so eager to save his child's life that he kills the family dog in order to use the heart as a transplant. The dog's...
It's a right B-movie.
Yeah, totally. I thought this one sounded quite good, actually. I'd quite like to see this on film. The dog's spirit lives on in the child and ultimately has its revenge against the father.
Nice.
Yeah, I think that would be quite good.
Get the rights.
Jennifer also wrote Discomania, the story of a young woman who discovers that the atmosphere of the local disco incites patrons to insane violence. She followed up with The Taxi Driver's Son, a radio play called Postman
like
and Postwoman, and several short stories. June Gibbons is considered to be what's called an outsider writer.
What was The Taxi Driver's Son about?
Oh, it don't say.
Oh.
So you've got Taxi Driver's Son and then the radio play Postman and Postwoman.
Postman and Postwoman.
And several short stories, but I don't know. But I'd be quite interested to know. I'd be quite up for reading some of them.
Should get hold of them.
Yeah, have to see if you can. So, yeah, she's considered to be what's called an outsider writer. So outsider art in general is apparently art by self-taught or naive art makers. Typically, those labelled as outsider artists have little or no contact with the mainstream art world, and in many cases, their work is only discovered after their deaths. Often, outsider art illustrates extreme mental states, unconventional ideas, or elaborate fantasy worlds.
All right, okay.
Yeah, and randomly, that made me think of that guy. You've seen Scanners, haven't you?
A long time ago.
Oh, okay. There's this dude that they go looking for, and he's an artist. I looked him up. His name's Benjamin Pierce. But his art, that's what that makes me think of, when he does all like the sculptures of schizophrenia and stuff, and the
really?
Voices in his head. His stuff's amazing.
Wow.
So good.
Okay.
Really good. So, yeah, it's that kind of artist, you know, who's just in tune with their creativeness of mental illness and stuff. And, yeah.
Mm. Well, it's just a venting venting it in an artistic way.
Yeah.
But it's a good way of fighting the demons
and
slightly winning.
Yeah.
Slightly having more of a control of them because you can, you know, bring them out.
In their later teenage years, the twins began experimenting with drugs and alcohol. In 1981, the girls committed a number of crimes, including vandalism, petty theft and arson, which led to them being admitted to Broadmoor Hospital.
Really? So, I didn't know if they were going to end up being some sort of weird killers or something.
No, that's all they did.
So they were just stealing...
Just stealing
cars,
stuff, I think.
Maybe setting the cars on fire?
I think it was June, maybe, that had done it. She set fire to a... I think it was a tractor shop or something like that she set fire to. It's in the documentary.
A lot of damage,
And they were admitted for that. I suppose kind of previous history maybe of them not talking, you know, or...
And they're just looking at it. So,
yeah, because I think arson used to be a big reason why people were admitted to Broadmoor, you know, setting fire to things.
What age were they doing? Like,
that's kind of like teenage.
Okay.
Age.
15, 16, sort of.
I think, yeah, well, a little bit older than that, maybe 16, 17.
Okay. Well, it's quite a full-on thing, arson, yeah, especially sort of a bigger place.
Cause yeah, if it causes a lot of damage and stuff, yeah.
Okay.
The twins were sentenced to indefinite detention under the Mental Health Act, and they remained at Broadmoor for 11 years. June later blamed this lengthy sentence on their selective muteness, saying, "Juvenile delinquents get 2 years in prison. We got 12 years of hell because we didn't speak. And we lost hope. I wrote a letter to the Queen asking her to get us out, but we were trapped." Placed on high doses of antipsychotic medications, they found themselves unable to concentrate, and Jennifer apparently developed tardive dyskinesia, which is a neurological disorder resulting in involuntary repetitive movements.
Right.
Their medications were apparently adjusted enough to allow them to continue their copious diaries they had begun in 1980, and they were able to join the hospital choir, but they lost most of their interest in creative writing.
That's a shame.
Yeah, definitely. Their case achieved notoriety due to newspaper coverage by journalist Marjorie Wallace of the Sunday Times. Wallace later wrote a book about the sisters called The Silent Twins, published in 1986, and that's the one I was saying to you about earlier. You can get it on Amazon for like a fiver, Kindle edition.
Right.
It looks quite good. According to Wallace, the girls had a long-standing agreement that if one of them died, the other must begin to speak and live a normal life. During their stay in the hospital, they began to believe it was necessary for one of them to die, and after much discussion, Jennifer agreed to sacrifice herself.
That's so hard.
I know. Like,
them being with each other, having this connection, and like one's, it's like, who's going to be able to take it with me not here, or one of the others not here, because we both are so close to each other?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Jennifer was the one who wasn't happy, you know, because she was a little bit taller than June. And she was saying, like, they had different... They wanted to do different things. So she didn't believe that they were actually twins. She thought that someone else out there was going to be more like her than her sister would be.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, I think she was probably the more mentally unwell of the two.
Yep.
In March 1993, the twins were transferred from Broadmoor to the more open Caswell Clinic in Bridgend, Wales. On arrival, Jennifer could not be roused. She was taken to the hospital, where she died soon after of acute myocarditis, which is a sudden inflammation of the heart. There was no evidence of drugs or poison in her system, and her death remains a mystery. Apparently, like, that's seldom fatal, the dude was saying on the documentary as well. It's like, that's not something that you would die of.
Really?
Yeah. At the inquest, June revealed that Jennifer had been acting strangely for about a day before the transfer. Her speech had been slurring, and she said she was dying. On the trip to Caswell, she had slept in June's lap with her eyes open. On a visit a few days later, Wallace recounted that June was in a strange mood. She said, "I'm free at last, liberated, and at last Jennifer has given up her life for me." After Jennifer's death, June gave interviews with Harper's Bazaar and The Guardian, and by 2008 she was living quietly and independently near her parents in West Wales. She was no longer monitored by psychiatric services, had been accepted by the community, and sought to put the past behind her.
Wow.
A 2016 interview with her sister Greta revealed that the family had been deeply troubled by the girls' incarceration. She blamed Broadmoor for ruining their lives and neglecting Jennifer's health. She had wanted to file a lawsuit against Broadmoor, but Aubrey and Gloria refused, saying that it wouldn't bring Jennifer back.
That's so crazy, like, the other, that it's almost weirder, like, she's now been accepted, etc. I'm sure, like, if they were both twins, had been let off and not having psychiatric observations of them anymore.
Yeah.
I'm sure they both may have been accepted as twins, but like the fact that it's not and just one person, the other twins never coming back. They've gone. It's just one person. It's not a twin anymore.
Yeah.
You know, that might have even helped her become more accepted.
Yeah.
Easily accepted.
Yeah.
Quicklier.
Yeah.
And that's quite such a sad story.
And like it was saying in the documentary as well, Jennifer was kind of like, you know, we make each other worse when we're together as well. So she kind of understood, you know, that they were exacerbating the symptoms of each other, you know, and kind of not
they
speaking.
Egged each other on.
Yeah. But yeah, it's crazy. Sad, crazy story.
Hmm. But one of them's still alive now.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And
she's just getting on with her life,
podcast,
I suppose.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Oh. Hi.
But yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Bonkers story.
Absolutely. And basically, when it comes down to also incarcerated for arson, and like she says, like just because we didn't speak and we've got our little thing going on, like they think we're crazy and look,
yeah, it was saying in the documentary,
which would have made them worse anyway.
Yeah,
ultimately destroying them and separating them.
Was one lady who was kind of working with them, and she's kind of videotaped some of the sessions of working with them and stuff. But they're also saying, you know, there's so many doctors who are quick to go, they're schizophrenic, you know, where they're not necessarily.
And again, just being a time, just easier to just jump to that without, you know, more extensive...
Yeah, definitely.
...observations or tests of different
types. Yeah, it's just being lazy, I suppose, isn't it?
And when it comes down to did arson, there's going to be kids out there who, yeah, like they're saying, like... do arson and get a couple of years, but that's just because it's like, you know, fuck, what should we do, let's go fuck yourself after this, you know.
But yeah, I think with them it's a culmination of everything else as well, because they'd not been speaking, you know, since they were at school and stuff, the reason
they're locked up is because they think they're going to do it again and they might kill someone.
Yeah,
that's essentially why they've done it.
Yeah,
that would be their logic.
Yeah,
well, I can see that point. But,
I think 11 years, more tests,
absolutely.
Just seems
almost
a bit...
like a forgotten case, almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, okay, fine.
Okay.
Carry on.
Thanks.
Last time, though, we did a yes, they should be in Broadmoor. No, they shouldn't be in Broadmoor after each case. So the first case, he should be in Broadmoor.
Yeah, well, I think he should be as well.
Unfortunately,
he needs some help.
Not,
yeah.
But he should be.
He needs some help and he should be there.
Let's get him there.
Let's
vote to get him there.
Start a petition to get Robert Maudsley transferred to Broadmoor.
Absolutely. Someone start that. And then the twins, unfortunately, one person now, not a twin.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. But next one, yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to go yes before I know the facts. Well, I know the facts already, but... he's a lovely gentleman, isn't he?
Oh, he's awful, isn't he?
Mm, he's someone that shouldn't have been put on the earth, really.
No.
Okay.
And the crazy thing about this case is that he was interviewed by the police so many times and let go.
Yeah.
And I was watching the Netflix thing on this guy as well. They were saying, like, the place where he worked, the lorry place where he worked, they all used to joke and call him the Ripper, and this dude was like, that was his nickname when he was at work.
Yep.
We'd come in, he'd be walking around the yard, we'd go, oh, it's you, isn't it? You know, oh, here comes the Ripper, and laugh. And he was like, it's fucking true. And we didn't know.
That's insane.
You know, it's crazy. This was one of the biggest police kind of manhunts as well that Britain's ever seen.
A lot of
these
wasted
guys.
Opportunities and resources wasted because they had chances to...
They interviewed him so many times, but also with this as well, everything was on paper. All the kind of information that they had was on paper. It was saying in the documentary they even had to have some dudes in to come reinforce the floor in the office where they were keeping all the information, because it was so much paper to go through. You know, they didn't have a computerised system at the time, so it was just all on paper, everything. People phoning up, giving you tips and stuff. You know, you write it down, you put it in the room with all the paper in.
But that's it.
They came in and reinforced the floor.
The site paperwork, the amount of times missed is because of the way the organisation was as well.
Yeah, totally.
Not to anybody's fault, but technology not being up to par.
Well, also, if you watch the if you watch the Netflix documentary, the UK Netflix one, they're saying like there was other women that were attacked, but it was because the police, the couple of police dudes that were in charge,
they didn't come forward.
They were just totally disregarding their cases, saying it wasn't the same guy, because the guy they were looking for killed,
they think the MO was different,
killed prostitutes,
right?
Where he didn't necessarily kill prostitutes,
they
he
just
attacked
assumed,
loads
it's
of different
like Jack
women.
The Ripper.
So then they did lump women in and kind of go, oh, you know, she likes to go out drinking. Because a couple of the women, they did leave their kids, you know, and go off and drink and kind of go out at night, leaving their kids at home.
Yeah, yeah.
But then they're kind of going, oh, she must have been a prostitute as well, you know, and kind of lumping them in with that.
Yeah.
So they disregarded the attacks on other women who weren't
and
sex workers.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, we were saying prostitutes because then that was obviously...
Yeah, that was the name for my... I have changed all that to sex workers in my notes,
but, okay, honest. So now just say sex workers.
Yeah, but they're kind of like lumping them in with them as
well. General women, yeah.
You know, so a lot of the attacks went disregarded by the police as well.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah.
So they missed evidence, you know, they missed things that they could have corroborated with other cases because they just disregarded that guy. He's not the same guy. So, yeah.
But eventually he was caught.
Eventually he was. With his hair and all.
Hair and all. And his funny pants. He wears funny pants, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. He's got some disgusting sex attack.
Sex,
no, it was a jumper, weren't it?
Oh, he made a jump. Made a
it's
pair
an
of
upside
pants
down
out of his jumper.
Cut. With his penis hanging out of the neck hole,
yeah,
and he
yeah.
padded his knees up. But I don't know why, because I don't think he actually assaulted anybody,
assaulted anybody,
from what... Yeah, but they never found any semen.
But why is he going to be doing, like, so precarious, even with the wind up his...
Yeah. But I was... Because I was listening for that, because I thought he was a sexual assaulter. But I was listening for that in the doco and also in my notes, and I don't think he did. So I don't know, yeah, unless he was knocking one out on something, taking it with him.
It's probably like old Weinstein knocking one out in a bush.
Yeah, maybe. And they missed it. They missed his jizz.
Jizz misses.
Silly.
It's not a TV show, dog.
Okay, so... Peter Sutcliffe, also known as Peter William Coonan, was an English serial killer.
He changed his name?
He did. He chose that name. I think that was his mum's name before she was married.
Didn't like his dad. Daddy problems.
If I'm right in thinking.
Daddy issues.
I can't remember, actually. He was an English serial killer who was dubbed the Yorkshire Ripper by the press. On the 22nd of May 1981, he was found guilty of murdering 13 women and attempting to murder seven others between 1975 and 1980. So he was fucking... He was on it. You know, that's like 20 women in 5 years.
Mm.
That's crazy. I'm not doing the math. But yeah, he was like all over that shit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Crazy man. Fucking dangerous. Sutcliffe was born in 1946 to a working class family in Bingley, West Yorkshire, and was raised a Catholic by his parents, John and Kathleen. Reportedly a loner, Sutcliffe left school aged 15 and had a series of menial jobs, including two stints as a gravedigger in the 1960s. Between November 1971 and April 1973, he worked at the Baird Television Factory on a packaging line.
So he's been a grave digger.
Yeah.
So he's going to be accustomed to the dead.
Yeah.
And slightly probably desensitised.
Yeah.
Okay. And he killed 3 to 4 people then. That would be a year.
Okay.
That's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's almost seasonal.
Yeah, definitely.
It's winter, you know.
Bump another one off.
And April showers.
Yeah. He left his position when he was asked to go on the road as a salesman. After leaving Baird Television, Sutcliffe worked night shifts at the Britannia Works of Anderton International from April 1973. In February 1975, he took redundancy and used half of the £400 payoff to train as a heavy goods vehicle driver. On the 5th of March 1976, Sutcliffe was dismissed for the theft of used tyres. He was unemployed until October 1976 when he found a job as a HGV driver for T&WH Clark Holdings Limited on the Canal Road Industrial Estate in Bradford.
He's done loads of jobs.
He has, yeah. He's done some work, hasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, okay. So he seems to be a fairly normal person. The jobs are finished and he's going on to new jobs not because he's been fired, because of his choice in himself.
Yeah, well, like one of them, you know, he got made redundant. Obviously, okay, he did get sacked for nicking tyres, but I would think that's probably kind of a general thing. I'm sure he's not the only person to have done that.
Yeah.
By some reports, Sutcliffe hired prostitutes as a young man, and it has been speculated that he had a bad experience during which he was conned out of money by a prostitute and her pimp. Other analyses of his actions have found nothing to support this, but note that he did develop an obsession with them, including watching them soliciting on the streets of Leeds and Bradford.
So he sort of sat in his car watching
them
get punters?
Yeah. Sutcliffe met Sonia Zuma on the 14th of February 1967 and they married on the 10th of August 1974. Sonia suffered several miscarriages and they were informed she would not be able to have children. She resumed a teacher training course, during which time she had an affair with an ice cream van driver. When Sonia completed the course in 1977 and began teaching, she and Sutcliffe used her salary to buy a house at 6 Garden Lane in Heaton, Bradford, moving in on the 26th of September 1977 and still residing there at the time of Sutcliffe's arrest. Through his childhood and his early adolescence, Sutcliffe showed no signs of abnormality, but one of his brothers admitted that their father was an abusive alcoholic and that he had once smashed a beer glass over Peter's head for sitting in his chair at the Christmas dinner table.
That's definite daddy issues. Daddy is a bit of a twat.
That's not good, is it? And I would say that if he does something like that, he does something pretty similar most of the time. Because not many people just all of a sudden smash a glass over their son's head, do they? Without generally being a bit of a fucking cunt, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Surely you're going to be a bit of a dick, like, most of the time, if you're going to do that shit.
It's pretty fucking full on, isn't
it? Yeah, totally. My uncle punched my brother out once when we were at the table for no reason at all. Just totally punched him out and knocked him off his chair. And my uncle was a fucking cock. I swear he was mentally ill. Really badly.
Sounds like
he was a dick all the time. So, like, this dude, I don't imagine that was a one-off.
Right. Don't have any brothers or sisters, so.
No one in your family to get punched out, then.
No, I didn't get punched out, no. Sorry for that, then.
Shit happens, don't it?
But imagine when you're young and having this stuff, like, and you've got two people, you need the male and female, much as you do. I feel like I can't totally two women can and two men can foster children, which is absolutely fine, but having a male and female as your mum and dad, who are your biological, you've grown up with as a baby, you're trusting upon these two people, you know, like, and having that male role model type thing, obviously the female role model as well, but having that, but then you trust completely, you just like, what did I do? Your whole time it's gonna be like, it's apart from physical pain, the mental pain, anguish is, what did I do to deserve that?
Yeah.
Why did I do that? What am I doing wrong? Because obviously you think that they must know right.
Well, yeah, that's a huge blow,
they know,
isn't it?
They know right because they're older than me, and you know,
for that to come from any kind of parental figure,
being like that father figure, yeah,
or any, you'd like, yeah, you know, for that to come from any kind of parent to a child,
it's going to be such a massive blow. And there you go. There's the little seed planted of this serial killer.
Yeah. So, you know, but then
it doesn't mean that he's completely going to be a serial killer from this, but it's a distilled, it's a kind of really different look on life. It's completely like not what is the norm. It's slightly like skew if it's a bit hazy. It's a bit like what's the clear, you know, which way do I look to go as a person?
Well, I think the thing is, you know, obviously his dad was violent, so his dad was violent to his mum, therefore he's seen women as victims,
right?
So that's the kind of mindset, you know, that he's in.
Yeah.
He's just saying the woman is the victim because his mum took shit off his dad.
Yeah. Okay. It's fucked, basically.
Yeah, totally. Like, it's so easy for that to happen, you know.
Mm. And unfortunately, it happens all the time.
Yeah, definitely. Leeds was the hotspot of the Ripper's activity, with 6 murders, including the first and last, and 4 attacks in the city. So in 1969, Sutcliffe's first documented assault was of a female sex worker, whom he had met while searching for another woman who had tricked him out of money. He left his friend Trevor Birdsall's minivan and walked up to St Paul's Road in Bradford until he was out of sight. When Sutcliffe returned, he was out of breath, as if he had been running. He told Birdsall to drive off quickly. Sutcliffe said he had followed a sex worker into a garage and hit her over the head with a stone in a sock. According to his statement, Sutcliffe said, "I got out of the car, went across the road and hit her. The force of the impact tore the toe off the sock and whatever was in it came out. I went back in the car and got in." Police visited Sutcliffe's home the next day, as the woman he had attacked had noted Birdsall's number plate.
And this is head trauma he's
given. Yeah, yeah, really so, bad. So
he had head trauma given to him.
Yeah. He admitted that he had hit her, but claimed it was with his hand. The police told him he was very lucky, as the woman didn't want anything more to do with the incident.
Wow, so he got off there.
Yeah, totally.
Otherwise that could have stopped him.
But then, yeah, because that's just giving him the green light then. He's like, well, absolutely, if I can get away with that, I can get away with fucking something worse.
Yeah, it's no comeuppance whatsoever.
Yeah, totally. So 1975, Sutcliffe committed his second assault on the night of the 5th of July 1975 in Keighley. He attacked Anna Rogalski, who was walking alone, knocking her unconscious with a ball-peen hammer and slashing her stomach with a knife.
A hammer?
I know. Oh. It's awful. It's so bad.
I've seen hammers in movies.
Yeah, totally. That bit in Hellraiser where Julia just smashes that guy in the head with a hammer. It's like, fuck it. Oh, yeah, that's a bad one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's well bad, that one.
Yeah. And old vicious boy.
Yeah. Disturbed by a neighbour, he left without killing her. Rogalski survived after having neurological surgery at Leeds General Infirmary, but was psychologically traumatised by the attack. No fucking wonder. She said later, I've been afraid to go out as I feel people are pointing and staring at me. This whole thing has made my life a misery. I sometimes wish I had died in the attack.
Shit.
I know, it must be fucking terrible. It's so feel for these women. They're so it's just awful.
Yeah.
On the night of the 15th of August, Sutcliffe attacked Olive Smelt in Halifax. Employing the same MO, he briefly engaged her with a commonplace pleasantry about the weather before striking her with a hammer from behind. He then disarranged her clothing and slashed her lower back with a knife. Again, he was interrupted and left his victim badly injured but alive.
Shit.
Like the previous victim, Smelt subsequently suffered severe emotional and mental trauma.
And a fucking headache.
She had told interviewing officer Detective Superintendent Dick Holland that her attacker had a Yorkshire accent, but this information was ignored, as was the fact that neither she nor the previous victim were in towns with a red light area.
But it's a blow to the head, though.
On the 27th of August, Sutcliffe attacked 14-year-old Tracy Brown in Silsden. He struck her from behind and hit her on the head 5 times while she was walking along a country lane. He ran off when he saw the lights of a passing car, leaving his victim requiring brain surgery. Sutcliffe was not convicted of the attack, but confessed to it in 1992. The first victim to be killed by Sutcliffe was Wilma McCann on October 30th. McCann from Scott Hall in Leeds was a mother of four children between the ages of 2 and 7. Sutcliffe struck the back of her skull twice with a hammer, then inflicted a stab wound to the throat, 2 stab wounds below the right breast and 3 stab wounds below the left breast, and 9 stab wounds to around the stomach area. Really sad, that one as well. It was in the part of the documentary, like, all her kids were at home in bed on their own, and she'd gone out and she was like out having a drink and stuff, and obviously fucking picked up Sutcliffe or whatever Sutcliffe had seen her walking home on her own. And it was only like round the corner from her house, fucking murdered her, and all her kids were asleep in bed on their own. They're only little as well. It was fucking well shit.
She shouldn't have gone out.
No, totally. Like, you know, it was a different time then. But yeah, definitely, you don't do that when you've got 4 kids at home. It's not.
But shit for the kids.
Yeah, definitely. It was fucking.
And again,
awful.
Though, head trauma.
Mm.
So this is back to like
this is all this of them.
Is like him having head trauma from his dad. And yeah, it's all head trauma.
It's what he knows, isn't it?
It is, because he's seen his dad do it.
Fucking nasty, though, isn't it? Hammers.
It's very, very. It's like knifing as well. Because a gun is not a personal way to kill someone. From a distance, you pull a little trigger on your finger, and that's the end of it. Don't worry about it. A knife, you're going to have to actually push it into someone. I find that a bit yucky myself, to be on prospect definitely. To do that to someone.
Yeah.
You know? But like, hitting the head. Hit a hammer on someone's skull. It's going to make a cracking sound.
Yeah,
that shit.
Definitely.
Ugh, just hearing a cracking sound from that would make me feel ill.
Yeah, such a light.
It's really like I intend to very violently potentially kill you.
Yeah, that's what he's going for.
I'm going straight
it?
For the boom. Yeah, then to get a stab in the neck as well.
Oh, gross. An extensive inquiry involving 150 officers of the West Yorkshire Police and 11,000 interviews failed to find the culprit. In December 2007, Wilma's eldest daughter, Sonia Newlands, committed suicide, reportedly after suffering years of anguish and depression over the circumstances and the consequences of her mother's death.
I'm not surprised.
No, me either. Poor lady, poor family.
Absolutely.
1976, Sutcliffe committed his next murder in Leeds in January when he stabbed 42-year-old Emily Jackson 52 times.
Fuck.
In dire financial straits, Jackson had been persuaded by her husband to engage in sex work using the van of their family roofing business.
What, he didn't have enough work that he had to send his wife out to be a sex worker?
Yeah, on the game.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, mad.
It's just like, what, really? Like, that's the only thing you can think of doing?
Yeah.
Right.
Sutcliffe picked up Jackson, who was soliciting outside the Gaiety pub on Roundhay Road, then drove about half a mile to some derelict buildings on Enfield Terrace in the Manor Industrial Estate. Sutcliffe hit her on the head with a hammer, dragged her body into a rubbish-strewn yard, then used a sharpened screwdriver to stab her in the neck, chest and abdomen. He also stamped on her thigh, leaving behind an impression of his boot. Sutcliffe attacked 20-year-old Marcella Claxton in Roundhay Park, Leeds, on the 9th of May. Walking home from a party, she accepted a lift from Sutcliffe. When she got out of the car to go for a wee, he hit her from behind with a hammer. Claxton survived and testified against Sutcliffe at his trial.
How come he didn't do his normal MO of stabbing neck, chest,
and abdomen? It doesn't seem to do it to all of them.
Well, I started to see it. There was a pattern just a moment ago. Right, that guy then has sent his wife out. Bet he feels a bit guilty now.
Yeah, I bet.
Or did.
Yeah. At the time of the attack, Claxton had been 4 months pregnant and subsequently miscarried her baby. She required multiple extensive brain operations and suffered from intermittent blackouts and chronic depression.
Fuck.
1977.
That's almost just given a prison sentence, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Some of these, yeah, definitely. You know, some of these women just fucked up for life. You know, obviously they are anyway. You're never ever going to get over something like that. You'd be fucking terrified.
Yeah.
How scary would that be that someone could just, yeah.
You'd be waking up with nightmares every night.
Someone can just come up to you and fucking twat you with a hammer, you know.
And if you've got children, you'd be like, you're not going anywhere. You're staying here. And be like, Mum, chill out.
Yeah, you'd be so over the top, wouldn't you? It'd be so scary.
Yeah.
On the 5th of February, Sutcliffe attacked Irene Richardson, a Chapel Town sex worker in Roundhay Park. Richardson was bludgeoned to death with a hammer. Once she was dead, Sutcliffe mutilated her corpse with a knife. Tire tracks left near the murder scene resulted in a long list of possible suspect vehicles. 2 months later, on the 23rd of April, Sutcliffe killed Patricia Tina Atkinson from Bradford in her flat, where police found a boot print on the bedclothes. About 2 months later, on the 26th of June, he murdered 16-year-old Jane MacDonald in Chapel Town. She was not a sex worker, and in the public perception, her murder showed that all women were potential victims. Sutcliffe seriously assaulted Maureen Long in Bradford in July. He was interrupted and fled, leaving her for dead. She was suffering from hypothermia when she was found and spent 9 weeks in hospital. A witness misidentified the make of Sutcliffe's car, resulting in more than 300 police officers checking thousands of cars without success. On the 1st of October, Sutcliffe murdered Jean Jordan, a sex worker from Manchester. In a confession, Sutcliffe said he realised the new £5 note he had given her could be traced, and after hosting a family party at his new home, he returned to the wasteland behind Manchester's Southern Cemetery, where he had left the body, to retrieve the note. Unable to find it, he instead mutilated her corpse and moved it.
He just kind of... Why? Why did he then mutilate it? It was almost like anger, an excuse to go back. Oh, I guess. Yeah, okay.
Pissed off, maybe, that he couldn't find it. Yeah. On the 9th of October, Jean Jordan's body was discovered by local dairy worker and future actor Bruce Jones, who is... bloody Les Battersby from Coronation Street. I don't know if you know it.
Curly hair?
No. Okay. Quite loud, red cheeks, gingery kind of hair, always wearing double denim.
I'm sure.
I'm not big on Coro, but he was in it when I had seen it.
It's a British TV show. Yeah. Very long living, sort of set in Yorkshire type area. I've been on the set before.
Got the most boring theme tune in the world, that has.
Yeah, I've been in A Rover's Return, the pub.
Have you?
Hmm. Scratch my name, Gav, on the outside actually.
Gav was here.
I scratched on the outside.
So it's that dude. He had an allotment on land adjoining the site where the body was found and was searching for house bricks when he made the discovery.
Shit.
Yeah. The £5 note, which had been hidden in a secret compartment in Jordan's handbag, was traced...
Oh, sneaky.
Yeah. Was traced to branches of the Midland Bank in Shipley and Bingley. Police analysis of bank operations allowed them to narrow their field of inquiry to 8,000 employees who could have received it in their wage packet. Over 3 months, the police interviewed 5,000 men, including Sutcliffe. The police found that the alibi Sutcliffe had given for his whereabouts was credible. He had indeed spent much of the evening of the murder at a family party. Weeks of intense investigations into the origins of the £5 note led to nothing. On the 14th of December, all this time, all this manpower was crazy.
All woman power.
Yeah, sorry, all this person power.
Human power.
Yep.
Human power.
On the 14th of December, Sutcliffe attacked Marilyn Moore, another sex worker from Leeds. She survived and provided police with a description of her attacker. Tire tracks found at the scene matched those from an earlier attack, and her photo fit bore a strong resemblance to Sutcliffe, and she provided a good description of his car, which had been seen in red light districts. 1978, the police discontinued the search for the person who had received the £5 note in January. Although Sutcliffe was interviewed about it, he was not investigated further. He was contacted and disregarded as a suspect by the Ripper Squad on several further occasions. That month, Sutcliffe killed again. Yvonne Pearson was a 21-year-old sex worker from Bradford. He repeatedly bludgeoned her about the head with a ball-peen hammer, then jumped on her chest before stuffing horsehair into her mouth from a discarded sofa under which he hid her body near Lum Lane. 10 days later, he killed Helen Ritker, an 18-year-old from Huddersfield. He struck Ritker on the head 5 times as she exited his vehicle before stripping most of the clothes from her body and repeatedly stabbing her in the chest. Her body was found 3 days later beneath railway arches in Garrard's timber yard. Sutcliffe, while in police custody, said about her murder, "I had the urge to kill any woman. The urge inside me was now practically uncontrollable."
Yeah, well, obviously, the amount he's at it.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks there's no stopping. And then the police, like, it's another get out of jail card. Go free card, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Just because the police have come around numerous times, what he knows of, the police have investigated him once, I guess, and he's got away with it. So it's literally like, great, I'm just going to keep going.
Well, yeah, that's it. You know, they're pulling him in and then letting him go again. So it's like,
if you're a serial killer, you got to think, like, the whole time, I'm probably going to get caught. You know. He did the Golden State Killer, who went on for years, didn't he? He went on for years and years.
Yeah, and got away with it for years and years, you know. And probably thought, they're never going to get me. That was so many years ago, they're not going to kind of go back there.
But, like, you must sort of think that a little bit, I guess, apart from Golden State Killer, eventually got so long, you thought, oh, I don't know. But you must think, like, yeah, I'm going to get caught at any point. Get those killers and get caught. And then it's like, yeah, oh, I did it, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, cool, you got me. Yeah, I've been waiting for this.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to start doing that, you're playing at the top of the level, as in full on out there killing people, go down for life, you know.
Yeah.
It's the top of, like, oh my gosh.
This is just like crazy rampage, isn't it? It's fucking all the time.
Crazy, crazy. But you must think that. So, like, if he's just still, he's just like, fuck it, I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
Stop me. If you stop me, cool. I'm just going to keep going until you do. Wow.
So, on 1979, on the 4th of April, Sutcliffe killed Josephine Whittaker, a 19-year-old building society clerk whom he attacked on several... Bloody get it right today. He attacked on Savile Park Moor in Halifax as she was walking home. Despite forensic evidence, police efforts were diverted for several months following the receipt of a taped message, supposedly from the murderer, taunting Assistant Chief Constable George Oldfield of the West Yorkshire Police, who was leading the investigation. And we're going to have a listen to that now.
Cool.
I'm Jack. I see you are still having no luck catching me. I have the greatest respect for you, George. Good Lord. You are no nearer catching me now than 4 years ago when I started. I reckon your boys are letting you down, George. They can't be much good, can they? The only time they came near catching me was a few months back in Chapeltown when I was disturbed. I warned you in March that I'd strike again. Sorry it wasn't Bradford. I'm not quite sure when I'll strike again. But it will be definitely sometime this year. I'm not sure where. Maybe Manchester. I like it there. There's plenty of them knocking about. They never learn, do they, George? I bet you've warned them, but they never listen. Well, it's been nice chatting to you, George. Yours, Jack the Ripper.
So he's calling himself Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, so the police received some letters and also that tape. And that was from a guy who was hoaxing, but he was pretending that he was the Ripper.
I was going to say, he wasn't very much of a poetic person, was he?
No, he's got a seriously monotone voice as well.
Just the same thing over and over.
Yeah.
Okay.
Based on the recorded message, police began searching for a man with a Wearside accent, which linguists narrowed down to an area of Sunderland. Two letters were sent in to the police and the Daily Mirror in March 1978, boasting of the crimes, and the letters were signed Jack the Ripper, and they claimed responsibility for the murder of 26-year-old Joan Harrison in Preston in November 1975. At the time, police mistakenly believed that the Preston murder was not public knowledge. The tape and the letters were found to be a hoax, and the case was reopened in 2005. DNA taken from the envelopes was entered into the national database and found to match that of John Samuel Humble, an unemployed alcoholic and long-time resident in Sunderland, whose DNA had been taken following a drunken disorderly offence in 2001. On the 20th of October 2005, Humble was charged with attempting to pervert the course of justice for sending the letters and the tape, and he was remanded in custody. On the 21st of March 2006, he was convicted and sentenced to 8 years in prison, and he died on the 30th of July 2019, aged 63. So that was a little diversion as well that the police had to deal with. Obviously, they kind of went off on this mission thinking that that was actually the guy that they were looking for. So they're putting all their attention on that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Sutcliffe's just out there murdering. You know, so that's another distraction that they had.
So they went after this other fella.
Yeah, they went after this fucking idiot guy. Like, what the fuck?
Why is he even bothering doing
that? I know. He must be super sad to be doing that shit. Yeah, they fucking sentenced him to 8 years for it. But that's another one, you know.
Because obviously, it's a waste of, like, obviously, they sent the sentence that long to stop people doing it again.
Well, yeah, but
it's an example. Like, don't do this. We need to, like, stop a killer. And you're just making this go away from the killer.
But like, this is another case of him thinking he's got away with it, you know. This was so many years later. What was that, knocking on for 1980?
Yeah,
you know, this is 2006, where he got 8 years. So he's fucking like, whatever that is, 26 years later.
Yeah,
you know, then he's got arrested for it.
Yeah,
so yeah, it's fucked up though. Like, why do that?
Barmy, isn't it?
It's
calling out for help, but like, again, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose.
Maybe you need to be at Broadmoor.
Yeah. We clearly needed some kind of help, because that's just fucking bonkers. Maybe he was hoping that they'd just get locked up.
Maybe he wanted to be locked up.
Yeah. On the 1st of September 1979, Sutcliffe murdered 20-year-old Barbara Leach, a Bradford University student. Her body was dumped at the rear of Ashgrove under a pile of bricks close to the university and her lodgings.
So do you think he's like kind of just wandering around with a hammer in his bag at any opportunity?
Yeah.
He's going out going tonight's the night?
I think
he walks the streets until he finds a victim.
Yeah, I think.
Or he's just taking chances left, right and centre.
Yeah, I think he just took his chances where he could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think he was out most nights, like spying on sex workers and stuff and doing stuff like that. And I suppose, like, if the feeling came upon him, I can imagine that he would have been prepared for it.
Yeah.
In case he felt like it.
And the fact that he feels slightly invincible.
Yeah.
Fucking crazy, isn't it? Just having someone out there like that.
I know, this is what I mean.
And obviously the sex workers must have been like, what the fuck, we're all sort of scared, but...
Well, yeah, you know, and the police were... It shows you on the documentary, the police going, oh, I've been out there, I've told them, you know, they're fucking stupid for doing this and still being out there. But it's true, the women were saying, like, what choice do we have? You know, if you've got children at home that are hungry, you've got no other way of making money, what choice do we have apart from to be out here?
I know, earlier when it is one of the most dangerous. Out, it's like, can you not think of anything to do? But I think in that sense, like, it's your wife who you love. You surely don't want them to do that.
Yeah.
But, like, obviously, coming from that sort of industrial area, the jobs weren't, you know, it's not London.
Yeah.
There's not a load of different types of jobs you can do.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, you're stuck and, like... It's only going to pay you so much because everybody wants to do it.
Yeah,
everyone
of course.
Needs to work.
Yeah.
So they can charge, they can pay low salaries.
Yeah. And that's always it's always a dangerous kind of way of work to get into
being
out on the street.
Absolutely.
You know, you're always fucking taking your life in your own hands, really, doing that. But it's true what they're saying. You know, what choice do they have?
No, absolutely.
They've got to be out there, got to be earning money. They're not going to do it any other way. So, like,
yeah,
Yeah, it's the sad truth of it.
Absolutely.
The murder of another woman who was not a sex worker again alarmed the public. Despite matching several forensic clues and being on the list of 300 names in connection with the £5 note, Sutcliffe was not strongly suspected. He was interviewed and released by the police a total of 9 times. In 1980, in April, Sutcliffe was arrested for drunk driving. While awaiting trial, he killed 2 more women. He murdered 47-year-old Marguerite Walls on the night of 20th of August and 20-year-old Jacqueline Hill, a student at Leeds University, on the night of the 17th of November. Hill's body was found on wasteland near the Arndale Centre. He also attacked 3 other women who survived: Upadhyaya Bandara in Leeds on the 24th of September, Maureen Lee, an art student, attacked in the grounds of Leeds University on the 25th of October, and 16-year-old Teresa Sykes attacked in Huddersfield on the night of the 5th of November. So he's fucking going for it, you know. It's just insane the amount of attacks that he's making. Crazy. Just so dangerous, such a dangerous man to have on the street.
Absolutely.
Just insane. It must have been terrifying.
Absolutely.
On the 25th of November, Trevor Birdsall, the guy from the beginning, whose van Peter Sutcliffe was
jumped
in.
Yeah. Who told him to drive and I'll just hit someone.
Yeah.
So that guy, surely the police, like, did he come forward and say, like...
Well, I'm just about to do a little
thing on him. I was wondering what happened about this guy.
Yeah.
And the fact that Peter also trusted him to say this stuff.
Yeah,
I mean?
Definitely. An associate of Sutcliffe and the getaway driver, as Sutcliffe fled his first documented assault in 1969, reported him to the police as a suspect, but the information vanished into the mountain of paperwork already accumulated, so he did try. On the 2nd of January 1981, Sutcliffe was stopped by the police with 24-year-old sex worker Olivia Reavers in Sheffield. A police check by probationary constable Robert Hyde revealed Sutcliffe's car had false number plates, and he was arrested and transferred to Dewsbury Police Station. At Dewsbury, he was questioned in relation to the Ripper murders, as he had many of the known physical characteristics. The next day, police returned to the scene of the arrest and discovered a knife, a hammer, and rope he had discarded when he briefly slipped away from the police after saying he was bursting for a pee.
So, right, okay.
So he's chucked all his shit in the bushes.
Yeah.
It's quite funny, actually. It's like it interviews the dudes that arrested him, and they're like, "Oh, so how did you manage to find this guy, you know?" And this dude's like, "Well, it was just coppering, just straightforward coppering." And just like, I just went back to look, you know. I was like, "Fucking hell, it's the Ripper, it is him." Sutcliffe hid a second knife in the toilet cistern at the police station when he was permitted to use a toilet. The police obtained a search warrant for his home and brought his wife in for questioning. When Sutcliffe was stripped at the police station, he was wearing an inverted V-neck sweater under his trousers.
Oh, no!
There we are.
He's wearing his sex pants.
Yeah. The sleeves had been pulled over his legs and the V-neck exposed his penis.
Imagine that. Then he's like, "Oh, okay, take your clothes off."
Yeah, you'd be like,
what? That'd be the first time they've seen that.
Yeah, totally. I don't know of anyone else.
Straight
that's
away,
done
you
this.
Go, "Sank's up with this guy."
Yeah, definitely.
So obviously they found,
like,
the knife.
That's not our man.
Yeah, exactly. So eventually, obviously, they did find the knife he hid in the toilets.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Cheeky git.
Mm. The fronts of the elbows were padded to protect his knees.
After that means he's like on his knees.
He must
probably
be doing something.
Hmm. Protecting his knees, yeah.
Yeah.
Knee pads, fucking hell.
After 2 days of intensive questioning, on the afternoon of the 4th of January 1981, Sutcliffe suddenly declared he was the Ripper. Over the next day, he calmly described his many attacks. Weeks later, he claimed God had told him to murder the women. "The women I killed were filth," he told the police. "Bastard prostitutes," sorry, that is in the words of the Ripper, "litter in the streets. I was just cleaning the place up a bit." Sutcliffe only showed regret when talking of his youngest victim, Jane MacDonald, and when questioned about the killing of Joan Harrison, he vehemently denied any involvement.
Why would he do that?
I don't know. In 2011, DNA evidence revealed that she had actually been... Oh, because he didn't do it, that's why.
Oh, right.
In 2011, DNA evidence revealed that she had actually been murdered by convicted sex offender Christopher Smith, who had died in 2008. Sorry, right, I forgot about that bit. Sutcliffe was charged on the 5th of January 1981. At his trial, he pled not guilty to 13 charges of murder, but guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility, with the basis of his defence being that he considered himself the tool of God's will. Sutcliffe said he had heard voices telling him to kill sex workers while working as a gravedigger, which he claimed originated from the headstone of a Polish man, Bronislaw Zapalski, and that the voices were from God.
Right.
Sutcliffe pled guilty to 7 charges of attempted murder, and the prosecution intended to accept his plea after 4 psychiatrists diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia. But the trial judge, Justice Sir Leslie Borum, demanded an unusually detailed explanation of the prosecution's reasoning. After a 2-hour representation by the Attorney General, Sir Michael Havers, a 90-minute lunch break and another 40 minutes of legal discussion, the judge rejected the diminished responsibility plea and the testimonies of the psychiatrists, insisting that the case should be dealt with by a jury. The trial date was set for the 5th of May 1981. The trial lasted 2 weeks, and despite the efforts of his counsel, Sutcliffe was found guilty of murder on all counts and was sentenced to 20 concurrent sentences of life imprisonment.
Wow.
The jury rejected the psychiatrist's testimonies that Sutcliffe suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. Because the thing with that, they were saying in the documentary, is apparently his wife had suffered from paranoid schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
So they were thinking, is he just really clever and he can just mimic the symptoms of that enough to fool the psychiatrist?
Which is a wise thing for them to think that.
Yeah. So that was kind of like, is that what's going on here?
They were both a little bit.
Yeah.
Right.
Possibly influenced by the evidence of a prison officer who overheard Sutcliffe say to his wife that if he could convince people he was mentally ill, he would possibly get 10 years in the loony bin, quotation marks.
So he might have been playing with
it. Yeah, so he could have been. He could have been just trying to pull that off.
Right. Oh, he did pull it off.
Yeah.
Okay.
The trial judge said Sutcliffe was beyond redemption and he hoped he would never leave prison. He recommended a minimum term of 30 years before parole could even be considered. He began his sentence at HM Prison Parkhurst on the 22nd of May 1981. Despite being found sane at his trial, Sutcliffe was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, but attempts to send him to a secure psychiatric unit were blocked. While at Parkhurst, he was seriously assaulted by James Costello, a 35-year-old career criminal with several convictions for violence. On the 10th of January 1983, he followed Sutcliffe into the recess of F2, the hospital wing at Parkhurst, and plunged a broken coffee jar twice into the left side of Sutcliffe's face, creating 4 wounds which required 30 stitches. In March 1984, Sutcliffe was sent to Broadmoor Hospital under Section 47 of the Mental Health Act. Sutcliffe's wife obtained a separation from him around 1989 and a divorce in July 1994. On the 23rd of February 1996, like we were saying in the other episode, he was attacked in his room, but obviously Kenneth Erskine intervened on that one and saved him.
Right.
After an attack with a pen by fellow inmate Ian Kay on the 10th of March 1997, Sutcliffe lost the vision in his left eye.
Yeah, I remember that.
And his right eye was severely damaged. Kay admitted trying to kill Sutcliffe and was ordered to be detained in a secure psychiatric hospital indefinitely.
Right.
On the 22nd of December 2007, Sutcliffe was attacked by fellow inmate Patrick Sarida, who lunged at him with a cutlery knife while shouting, "You fucking raping, murdering bastard. I'll blind your fucking other one."
Fucking hell.
Yeah. Sutcliffe flung himself backwards, the blade missing his eye, but stabbing him in the cheek.
Shit, it was close then.
Yeah. In December 2015, Sutcliffe was assessed as being no longer mentally ill. And in August 2016, a medical tribunal ruled that he no longer needed medical treatment for his condition and that he could be moved back to prison.
So he's gone back anyway. So but he's had a time in psychiatric hospital for a while then, hasn't he?
Yeah. He was transferred to HMP Frankland in County Durham in August 2016. And Sutcliffe died at University Hospital in County Durham, aged 74, on the 13th of November 2020, after having previously been treated for a suspected heart attack 2 weeks before. He had a number of underlying health conditions, including diabetes, and he had refused treatment for COVID-19. I think we posted on the page when Peter Sutcliffe died, didn't we?
I think we did, yeah.
Yeah.
So he had coronavirus.
He did.
Good.
There you go. Got the Rona.
Wow.
There you go. That's Sutcliffe. That's like, that's scraping the surface of Sutcliffe. Obviously, you can go further into that. That Netflix UK documentary series is pretty good. Obviously, you get like interviews of the family of the victims as well. It's good to hear it from their side. And yeah, policey kind of stuff, you know. And
Peter Sutcliffe.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing to get into. Or like shed loads of documentaries about him on YouTube as well. But so, yeah, terrifying. Honestly, I can't even imagine what it must have been like to be kind of like, you know, an adult during that time in that area. Fucking such a dangerous man. Crazy.
So here's another patient of the famous Broadmoor Hospital. Yes. With all these cases you look at, do you see any way they're treated? What sort of treatment was administered?
Not really. Like, I don't know. Like, there isn't really any. I think they just use medication a lot of the time. You know, obviously, they used to use like ECT and stuff like that. Yeah, you know, and that would have been outlawed, and they'd just kind of use medication now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I suppose it's diagnosing them and then treating them medically.
Yeah.
And therapy, I would think.
And doping them up.
Well, yeah.
Keeping them docile, so to speak, maybe. So, yeah, crazy, isn't it? I just wondered what sort of thing they had going on there with like the doctors and stuff.
I think with a lot of them...
Especially it's the different cases, like let's say the twins, they're not going to be in such the same sort of level as Peter Sutcliffe. That's a whole other level.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, do they try and rehabilitate these people, you know? No, I shouldn't think so. I should think they're
different four factors of, like, yeah, these are harder guys, in, these are...
They'll be in categories of severity, won't
people
they?
People who are not, so, yeah.
Yeah. So, yes.
Quite fascinating. Yeah. Well, yeah, I wonder if there's anything we can find out for next time, maybe, if some of the treatments and things, you know... Just to conclude the Broadmoor Hospital. It's good going on in all these cases, but we don't want to forget about the hospital itself and just being like the hugest place in England. And being so big and being on for so long, we've had all these cases come and go, especially these famous ones in England, because we don't have a huge amount of serial killers in England, but we have got a handful or so.
Yeah, we've had a fair few.
Yeah, I guess. Interesting stuff, though. Well done.
Yeah.
Looking into all that.
Oh, that's all right.
And we never got to go there last weekend, did we? So
no.
I am gonna do a solo mission there to get a little selfie, which I can on the Instagram, the Facebook, and the old the Twitters.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining up recently on Instagram and all that stuff. There's quite a lot more of you now, which is very appreciative.
Yeah, thanks.
And all the downloads and listeners are all over the place. Thank you very much. If you're enjoying the show, please give us a review.
Yeah.
Give us a rate. Just it helps us to get out there. There's a lot of true crime shows out there.
Mention us to a friend as well if you're enjoying it. That'd be cool.
Tell a friend who can tell a friend.
Do a bit of word of mouthing.
Word of mouthing. Indeed. That's good. So we're coming back for part three.
Yeah, next time will be the conclusion.
And that is?
We are going to be looking at Charles Bronson, or Michael Gordon Peterson, as he was born, But yeah, we can't do Broadmoor and not look at old Charlie.
No.
So we're going to look at him. He's been referred to as Britain's most violent prisoner by the media. And also, we're going to do Barry Williams, who was a spree killer, and he shot 8 people in just over an hour. And that was kind of back in the late 70s, I think, early 80s. And then I think he went
in
to
England.
Then he went to Broadmoor, I think it is. And then he got out again. He got in trouble for like trying to blow his neighbours up over an argument over a fucking tree or some shit.
Right.
And got put back in Broadmoor.
Like a huge amount of gun cases like that, like in England, so much.
Yeah.
But just because the gun's been banned and things, so that's interesting, you know, to look at that and see how that developed and.
Yeah, totally. No, it's a bit of an unusual one.
That would have been a really shocking thing because we're
definitely
shocked if we see guns nowadays, aren't we?
That's super fast as well. Just over an hour to kill 8 people. That's like just bang, bang, fucking.
Absolutely.
Bonkers. And also, we're going to have a look at Robert Torto, who was a Ghanaian hate criminal, and he claimed to be the son of God.
Wow.
So we're going to have a look at them.
Jesus as a brother. Right, okay. Well, I look forward to that, and I hope everybody else has looked forward to that.
Yeah, and
I'll back again for
link
that.
Up all the documentaries that I've been watching from YouTube and stuff as well onto the Facebook page.
Absolutely.
And that documentary on UK Netflix, the series about the London nail bomber. I started watching that last night, and that's really interesting if anyone wants to give that a look.
Cool.
David Copeland, I think it was, nail bomber.
Okay.
Yeah, that's super good.
Do check out deadboltfilms.com for short films, feature films, another podcast on Haunted Hill, which I also co-host with my buddy. YouTube, Deadbolt channel on YouTube, Deadbolt Films. Type that in, and you can actually listen to these episodes on YouTube if you so want to, or see us doing little adventures. There's a couple of videos of us doing stuff.
We're going to do some more adventures like that, haven't we?
Absolutely, we've got some things planned, some visual video things. We went to an abandoned RAF building, didn't we?
Yeah, that was good.
Pretty much. Kind of interesting. And obviously don't forget to check out Foxy's Fantastic Fabrications on Etsy. Just go into Etsy and type that in and you can find Sarah's creative wooliness.
Yeah, you can find me on Facebook and Instagram under that as well. Come and have a look at my stuff.
Absolutely.
You want to.
Absolutely. And we've got a Patreon if you fancy like that. Or please just share us to someone with your friends. So, I've been checking this
definitely.
Out.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks very much. Wicked. Stay safe. Make sure you lock those windows and doors and hope Gary Busey's not peering in through the window like in Hider in the House.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good movie.
He was in the attic. I don't know if he'd be looking through your window. He's more likely to be looking for a crack, isn't he?
Yeah.
In your ceiling or something.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see. Right, everybody, take care of yourselves. We love you all.
We do, indeed. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.